If you don't want this.
No, no, that's fine, it's, this I don't want.
Okay.
I guess when it comes to writing, I always have written.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that I consciously learned to do. I know that by the time I was 10 years old, I wanted it to be what I, like I clearly know that at 10 years old,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to be a writer. Now, then what happened is, I got married at a very young age, well, I guess not that young, 18.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of my marriage, 3 years later, I had 2 children. And meanwhile, all this time, I was sort of writing poetry, writing. And I consider myself, at least in the early part of my career, primarily a poet.
Mm-hmm.
And after my marriage ended, I went to Winnipeg with my children, and there a few things got published.
Mm-hmm.
Because I started writing protest poetry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And at that time, it was, I suppose, the popular thing to do.
Was that in the 70s?
Yeah, that was in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up being published in a number of different places. Things are moving along for me quite
mm-hmm.
well in that
mm-hmm.
area.
Mm-hmm.
I supported myself through community development work
mm-hmm.
and through working with the Department of Education in Manitoba. I did a number of different things. And
did you work with Indian or Métis people or both?
Indian and
mm-hmm.
Métis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think I got my education, because
mm-hmm.
I virtually don't have an education of the sort that one normally considers to be
mm-hmm,
such.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that doesn't mean that I don't know anything.
No.
So anyway, I ended up, when I was about 29 years old, by then what had happened is I'd done many presentations of my work, had numerous poetry and short stories published, but when I was 29 years old, I was to do a national TV show. I wasn't the star or anything,
mm-hmm.
but I was one of the people involved in this show. And the night before, something very violent happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, because of the fact that I've had a traumatic life, somehow this strange connection happened in my head that said that it was because I was communicating that this thing had happened to me. And for 3 years I didn't write at all. And gradually began to write again strictly through the jobs that I had, memos that
mm-hmm.
were required, etc.
You were also a communications, is it called communications officer? Was it for a government organization?
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
Yes. Information.
So that
officer.
Involved writing information, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that involved writing too?
Yes, and those things happened just about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I did is I made a decision about 6 months after this incident. I was working in that information position. I made a decision that I had to go out of Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go to the people. And I had to find a better sense of myself, I guess, and a historical perspective to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was offered a job in northern Manitoba, and I went.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also disastrous. And so far as the community that I went to was very racist, and I was a divorced Native woman in a position of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
They'd never seen such a thing before. And it was quite disastrous, but I was there about 6 months, and I finally ended up down in London after
mm-hmm.
I did a few other things, such as go out to Morley and take my children on almost like a traditional pilgrimage
mm-hmm.
to a number of different places. While I was in Winnipeg, my earlier part of my life, not only did I write protest work, but I was very actively
mm-hmm.
and prominently involved in the movement at that time. And I put that aside and started getting serious about How am I going to raise these children on my own?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of future can I offer them? And I had to face within myself a number of very perplexing issues, such as, this is who I am.
Mm-hmm.
This is who I have been defined to be, I guess is a better term. And yet I don't fit anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I don't speak my language. I don't...
Were you raised in an urban surrounding?
I was raised in an urban surrounding in a household where, like, my mother's English.
Mm-hmm.
And so the language wasn't spoken in the home.
Mm-hmm.
My father was in the services, and
mm-hmm.
there was a lot of...
So you moved around?
Yeah, we moved around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Europe for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
for example. And so there was a total separation. The repatriation period started in Winnipeg, and I think that's one of the reasons why I became very fervent about different issues, is because
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden I was starting to see,
mm-hmm.
for the first time in my life, the reality of what life can be like in Canada if you're a member of a non-favored group.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, my feelings about that had always been, well, I can live through that. Very
Pretty
arrogant
children.
In a sense.
Mm-hmm.
But these people around me can't, my children can't.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I think my work career became heavily involved in the community development aspect. And looking at, you know, like what on a social level
mm-hmm.
Can be done to bring us out of a state of powerlessness.
Mm-hmm.
And I became involved in very many, I guess left-wing activities,
mm-hmm.
and you know, like,
mm-hmm.
and developed maybe a new personal way of looking at things. But I still don't think that I was out of the egg yet, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Still in the egg. And then I had, as I mentioned before, a very traumatic life. One disastrous thing after another. Because I didn't have that education, I worked harder and harder all the time
mm-hmm.
to prove myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I became quite successful
mm-hmm.
on the outside. And on the inside, I was dying.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was 37 years old, I had... I know this is a long story, getting back to writing, but I think these are important to...
Sure.
to why I looked at the work that I looked at and the way that I looked at it. When I was 37 years old, I was faced with a cancer scare. I was slapped in the hospital and had major surgery. And at the same time, I was in a relationship that was a very bad relationship. And I came out of the hospital. I had lost, in a very short period of time, 90 pounds. And my whole world started to just crumble around me. And right around this period of time, I developed further along in progressive alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
And I was called back to work. This never reflected in the work that I was doing for at that point in time the provincial government, the Ontario Women's Directorate. What it did is it spurred me on all the time to work harder and
mm-hmm.
harder.
Mm-hmm.
And I collapsed
mm-hmm.
a year later because they called me back to work early. All these other things were going on. My relationship ended drastically. It was just awful. And I ended up in physical collapse a year later. So at 38 years old, I had to start making, confronted my own mortality.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, hey, what's going on here? And I began to make some fairly drastic decisions
mm-hmm.
That were based on, I guess, some periods of epiphany.
Mm-hmm.
what Abraham Maslow refers to as peak experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I was being told, absolutely told, that there was something special that I was. There's something special that I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was on sick leave from the provincial government, I was off at the job.
If you wanted to check that.
No, no, it's okay. I don't expect to be playing this for anybody. Maybe I'm wrong. But I was offered the job in Timmins, and that's even strange.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted the job out.
That's in the article.
Yeah, that's in the article.
And the guy had this dream.
Those
things happen a lot.
They happen to me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And since I've started exploring that, I find out they happen to a lot of people.
They happen.
Yeah.
I can tell you weird stories, and coincidences are so clustered that you don't believe they're coincidences anymore. And first, if you come from, you said you were involved in leftist politics, and I come from a student period, from a Marxist background, so
mm-hmm.
anything that is not tangible just doesn't exist, I thought. And those things happened so much that that really sort of shook me in some of my beliefs. And I had a hard time accepting that at first, and now I'm just grateful they happened.
Yeah, just grateful.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that change is, like, here I'm talking also in terms of during the time that I was producing
mm-hmm.
My earlier stuff, it's very different
mm-hmm.
than the things that are right now.
Mm-hmm.
That change is reflected within my work, I think, strongly.
I think the idea of what I read from this one article where you went out with these computers into the communities to produce books, so there was a very practical and a very practical, also political reason to help let those languages survive. But there's the coming together of sort of writing. You said you started writing when you were 10, and the political activism, but in a different way.
Yes.
And that really, really impressed me. I thought that was very meaningful. And you said you're in a fix because you don't speak the language, and I see that dilemma too.
Yeah. And in fact, where I got to with that work was, I looked at it as being a math problem, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because there is that very logical, almost technical side
mm-hmm.
of me. And I said, hey, you know, like, if we've got 10 native writers in Canada,
mm-hmm.
They're going to have to produce 50 books each to come up with 250 books each in Ojibwe and Cree,
mm-hmm.
and that's providing they write in their own language.
Yeah, yeah.
And mathematically, it's impossible.
Yeah.
So I said, that's because I'm looking at this from
mm-hmm.
the wrong end of the funnel.
mm-hmm.
I don't know, no thank you. I have to turn this around and get back to the kinds of beliefs that I had when I was doing community work, which was it had to be the people.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be the people. I don't own all of Native culture.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our finest elders and most
mm-hmm.
respected elders don't own it either.
Mm-hmm.
None of us
mm-hmm.
know all of it. We're all an important piece of a massive
mm-hmm.
jigsaw puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go about finding the pieces and let's assemble it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the logical side. The other side said it was exactly the right thing to do in terms of for people to read this stuff. They have to know what's there.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you can explain just a little how you went about that.
How I went about the
mm-hmm.
project.
Through the project, did you get sort of the computers and all the stuff, and you took it out to communities?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of problems with the things that happened.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
In the
middle of it, the funding was cut, right?
Yeah, the funding was cut, but also that there are things that happen in the world that. It was really important because I had struggled for so many years on my own, like the Ojibwe Cree Cultural Center that in fact I had worked for,
mm-hmm.
Was part of the larger bureaucracy, which, you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. I worked at a college that was implemented through
true that bureaucracy is from the top.
That's right, top down.
I know exactly what you're talking about. So there was a lot of politics.
There was a lot of politics, and when I left there, I said to myself, that doesn't change my feeling what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
I, as an individual, have been given both a gift, and with a gift comes a responsibility. And I look at it from the spiritual perspective, and I say, something put me in the right place at the right time to do the right thing. And now I am obligated, out of love and gratitude, to do what I have been chosen to do. And that may be arrogant, but that's exactly how I felt and how I feel. As if I was in the right place at the right time doing the right thing. Unfortunately, the state of powerlessness of this person is, I do have to say, you know, like I'm still a divorced Native woman. And I am not a status Indian. We were part of the whole enfranchisement movement that...
I see.
And my father finally got reinstated into status about a year ago, but my father died in September, and before all of the things were unraveled that will allow me to at some point in time legally say I'm an Indian. So anyway, and so I'm in this political game. You add to that the fact I got light eyes, you know, and I end up in a lot of trouble. I said to myself, I'm going to do it anyway, and then I became involved with another organization that systematically went about taking apart that dream. Just let me do it. I know what I'm doing. I've got the technical expertise. I've got the social work expertise. I've got the teaching ability. I've got the experiential, popular education mind, you know? And it was terrible. And the outcome of all of this is that I applied for, as an individual artist, to get the funding done. I, because of the cutbacks in the funding, I had to go into communities that were road accessible, which, and here I get ethnocentric as hell, I say, damn it, you know, like when it's a Native writing workshop, why do other people show up? When I went to communities, the non-Native people controlled those workshops. As much as I could sit there and say, no, sorry, you know, like, because I don't want to also... it's a very sensitive thing to attempt to deal with non-Native people within those situations. There can be seven Native people in a room and the non-Native person will hog the conversation, hog the attention. One has to go through a whole educational process to get that one person to the point where they can understand, you know, basic symbolisms. And we're talking English here, we're not talking another language.
It's like classical situation of one or two men in the women's workshop.
It was pretty pretty disastrous on a field level, and because of the fact that I still don't know my own language, with the cutbacks came the ability to get the kind of support I needed to do the work, which were people that were familiar with the languages, familiar with the could install like the syllabics into the computer system that I have. And so we got a book done at Wabagoon 27, which is still in my computer.
In syllabic?
No.
Oh.
No, in English. And not only in Roman orthography, but in the English language. And so what I was capable of doing, and with all the restrictions of the project, is show a community can make their own book, no question about it. They can. But the worst part about the way that I had to look at funding was there's no support for this kind of thing in Canada. Where, how I was able to get funding was as an individual artist in media arts. not in literature, not in writing, not in anything remotely related to even cultural development,
mm-hmm.
media arts. And
So much for multiculturalism.
I don't know whether you've come across it, but within the Fence Post article, I talk about Robert Bringhurst.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, like...
He was the knight in shining armor.
He was the knight in shining armor.
That's a good term, because that's a very ambivalent term, right?
Well, the thing is that I quite appreciated his input, even though, like, it could be construed in a sense as being paternalistic. There are times when we need to reach out our hands and have
mm-hmm.
help. I mean, I was in a situation...
It's a dilemma. It's a dilemma also that I was talking to Renata about that, and
mm-hmm.
I'm in the dilemma too, because even if we're, well, white liberals, well-meaning or so, and if we put something in, which maybe is useful, hopefully, for Native people, at the same time it upholds the structure, right?
Sure, but I don't know...
Or it reaffirms the sort of power relationship?
Yeah, but I don't know how one gets around that. I had a situation a few years ago with somebody that had been a friend of mine for a really long time, him
mm-hmm.
and his wife. Actually, he'd been my boss, and
mm-hmm,
after
mm-hmm.
He was no longer my boss, the friendship with the family
mm-hmm.
remained. And he had become quite ill, and he had to have eye surgery shortly before Christmas, but he hadn't gotten around to buying his wife's gift yet. So I said, well, why don't I take you
mm-hmm.
around? I can do the driving,
mm-hmm.
you know, like I
mm-hmm.
can guide you from
mm-hmm.
store to store and give you maybe some input. Because I liked them both very much. I thought it would be a helpful thing to do. So I went to pick them up. And they were at a Christmas party. Like an early afternoon tea. The woman that was the hostess was from South Africa. She was disgusted that I had come to the door. She was terrible. She was just awful. And these good people let her do that. And I attempted to explain that I was there to good purpose, but I was a non-entity to her. I was not recognizable to her as a human being. And how, therefore, can I influence that person? Even though it does reinforce the structure, those people
mm-hmm.
should have said, but I'm your peer and it's not acceptable to me.
Well, in that case, I think that it would have not upheld the structure but destroyed it. Because
yes,
they would turn around
right.
against that woman and say, hey, part of that structure, you're so brainwashed. You can't even recognize human beings.
Mm-hmm.
To hell with it. This is a borderline.
That's
what they should have done.
And they didn't.
So it wouldn't have been upholding this. They upheld the structure by not doing it.
By not doing it. And that's where I believe that the help must come.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it's not help. It's in that case, it's self-help. Because we need re-education much more than the victims, quote, unquote. I mean, we're victimizing our own children, huh?
Oh, sure.
In bringing them up like that. Or we've victimized ourselves,
mm-hmm.
if you... Oh, no, I'm very much...
Yeah, but you're right. Like, I believe that, yes, in some ways we need to change. Maybe some of that change has to do with the acquisition of certain kinds of very... you know,
mm-hmm.
what I call transferable skills.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. I think it's less easy to transfer a set of ethics,
mm-hmm.
a spiritual way, than it is to learn how to operate
mm-hmm.
a computer.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the easy things.
Sure.
I guess what I'm talking about is what fundamentally forms good character.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the hardest thing to change.
Mm-hmm.
Personality reorganization is the hardest thing to undertake because
mm-hmm.
I've attempted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
At times I've been successful, but never 100%.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So anyway, yes, there's ways in which we need to change, but racism, sexism, classism are all from the same root.
That's true.
And until that is systemically dealt with within the people that in turn sit on us,
mm-hmm.
then we can, you know, we can take up arms, we can do all kinds of different things.
Mm-hmm.
But what we can't do is change the thinking process within another human being. And that's what has to, I don't know how that changes. I think it has to be through peer pressure, through revolution perhaps, which is the conclusion that I continuously reach. Because it can't go on the way it is. And that's not just for me, and that's not just for my children. It's because the circles of victimization are getting wider and wider and wider until the fact that, you know, like, one of these days people are going to realize that 97% of the people are suffering for 3%. And those social programs that I struggle to protect in a sense defeat my long-term purpose, because
all social works just put a little plaster on something that doesn't heal over that way.
That's right.
You were talking about this earlier, and you said you sort of did an assessment. Where did this come from? North America. It started October 12, 1492. But then you go back and you say you came to Aristotle and Plato. Okay, that may be sort of the ideological side of it. But then if you think of these evils, I don't know, like classism, sexism, racism, and they're twins, they always come together,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm. They sure do.
And they help each other in many wonderful ways. And I've been trying, and I've talked this over with a lot of people, I find it almost impossible. Yeah, I find it impossible to pinpoint down when it really started and where. And so I've got several theories, and one is that sort of with the... when I think it was Constantine, the Roman emperor, who all of a sudden declared Christianity, and he would struggle under the name of that Christian God. And if I think of North European history where my people come from, I see how Christianity was enforced, how people were butchered if they didn't bend their knees, and all this went on a thousand years ago. That certainly turned things around, and because with the Church came also the sexism, the patriarchy, and later on capitalism developed and imperialism or so. But even then, you go back to Greek periods, you have treatises about barbarians and a lot of racism. It was a slave, the classical Greeks was a slave-holding society. They had disempowered their own women. It goes on and on and on. And the Middle East, but certainly, if you take the time of Columbus, it spread from Europe.
I tend to, like in the larger picture yet, I tend to think that there is a spiritual relationship between people and the land.
Mm-hmm.
And that once a dominion over
is
attitude is established, whether that be, all the major religions of the world have that.
Yeah.
The only place that, and this isn't, I'm not saying this because I'm Aboriginal, I'm saying this because I've looked at it. And the only place I don't see that is within Aboriginal culture and lifestyle. And that's what's wrong. Dominion over is the process that comes through, I believe, the setting up of hierarchy.
Yeah.
And that when I talk circle, what I'm saying, damn it, is, you know, like, part of that circle is not only am I as valuable as you and vice versa, but that tree out there
I know.
Part of that circle.
Mm-hmm.
And so if, you know, like the water and the sky and all these things need to be equally honored and respected. And until we get to a place where and this is the other reason for my work with languages, because I feel that maybe we're some of the last voices that have the conceptual wisdom within the languages, that have the ability to say, hey, you know, like, you do have to think onto the seventh generation and say, I'm not going to divert that stream unless I can guarantee to my children's children, children's children, children's children, that will not negatively affect them. And that kind of thinking has been lost with the turning over of the turning away from a belief in a continuous state,
a cycle
to, hey, you know, like I've got, now my life expectancy is 72 years, and in 72 years I have to cram everything,
mm-hmm.
and to hell with everybody else and everything else,
mm-hmm.
because it doesn't continue
being 72. No, it's familiar
yeah.
thinking which enables hierarchies.
That's right.
The thinking I'm pretty sure about. But what interests me is, when did it start? What causes? I mean, if hierarchies are established, why? Who establishes hierarchy for what idea? To preserve private property, or is it earlier than that? So I think it's probably a much longer process, and it's not possible to really pinpoint.
I think it does go back, like from, I suppose, like I have a certain affinity for Neanderthal.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I do is some of the findings of Shinar Cave, where they found people that had old amputations that exist, that continued to be protected, etc., by the rest of the people around
even
them.
Brain surgery.
They found pollen,
mm-hmm.
That showed that flowers had been gathered from miles and miles around to show honoring and respect
mm-hmm.
in ceremony. That says to me that somewhere along the line, I wish to God that we were descended from Neanderthal. I think we're these, you know, thinking man is very stupid. We've over-specialized to the
mm-hmm.
point where, you know, like, I was in, this is a silly thing for me to say, but, you know, like, my IQ is very high, so what? Intelligence and wisdom are not synonymous terms.
No, of course not.
And Ferris Elger, Guinness World Book of Records, IQ 197, I've known him for 3-4 years, you know.
Mm-hmm.
God, I got into the Egghead Society,
mm-hmm.
you know, and these people are scary. And they're not just scary because they're weird. I mean, I can understand what they're talking about. I'm up there with them, but to me, don't pontificate to me about thinking when that thinking doesn't end up with anything reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Where's your feeling part? And that's the other thing that I look at is being, I suppose, when I look at the early philosophers and I see, you know, like the negation
mm-hmm.
of the intuitive and spiritual aspects. And I see that even in things such as the denial of the use of minor keys in music,
mm-hmm.
which open up the right brain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to look and see how the manipulation of our minds has gone on
mm-hmm.
for so damn long,
mm-hmm.
and the suppression of our feelings and our intuition and our ability to
mm-hmm.
establish those spiritual links, unless they're in within the rigid criteria of you know, like of the institutionalized religion that I set down for
right.
you.
Mm-hmm.
And right now what is happening in the Aboriginal community is starting to be the institutionalization of those religions, of the original teachings, whether that be, you know, like the use of tobacco, you have to walk around the circle this way and not that way, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, I'm not an Indian unless I wear braids,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And to me, like, I say, you know, it's how I am.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a ritualist.
Mm-hmm.
It's how I am, you know, like, and my relationship with everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is very much guided in part of my relationship with the Creator, the Great Spirit, and all the other things around me that are, at times I can't see, touch, taste, hear, feel, or smell. But they're real. They're just as real as everything
yeah.
else. So anyway, like, this is digressing, but this is where, like, within the articles that I write, I try to come from a perspective that says, I've got all this stuff to say, and I've
mm-hmm.
got 2,500 words to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now how can
yeah.
I incorporate all of that stuff? Which is why I use this, partially why I use the storytelling approach too, is
mm-hmm.
to get into the right brain
mm-hmm.
and say, hey, you know, like, there's this
mm-hmm.
other way of
mm-hmm.
thinking, looking
mm-hmm.
at things. And maybe that's what you need to be in touch with,
mm-hmm.
instead of the beginning, middle, and end hierarchy.
You know, there are, well, you're certainly aware of that, quite a few minority writers, minority women in particular, particularly women of mixed descent,
mm-hmm.
who really develop new ways, maybe it's not new ways, but who vocalize ways of looking at the world and teaching either side, because they have this unique position between.
Right.
And it's not between, and I think it's Gloria Anzaldúa, the Chicana, who talks about borderlands. She's Chicana.
Mm-hmm.
And not only in terms of geography and ethnicity, but in terms of gender, in terms of culture, in terms of language. She says, I'm not the margin anymore, I'm the center. And the centers of power, she doesn't say they're margins, but from that perspective which a critic in Europe has called liminality, and I think that's okay too, limes is the border. From that liminality, it opens up such a complex way of relating to various parts and bringing together things that we, being here or there, have no notion of. And I think it's this kind of perspective that brings together different worldviews and integrates in a person a totally new approach that is certainly needed and that is helping. And there are people out there in Europe that are very grateful for this and who address that. And I want you to know that.
You see, like I believe, I call it the straddle.
She uses the same.
Yeah.
I've straddled the border all my life. Exactly
yeah.
that. Yeah.
And I have at times another foot firmly planted in midair. Me, but that.
Where's the fourth?
Gee, I think I'm devolving here. But it's. I see. Okay, I'll just go back to this article that I will be appearing in the next Arts Craft magazine, because what it's called is getting out from under avoiding professional pathology,
mm-hmm.
and I sort of treat professionalism as a disease, and examine the pathotype,
mm-hmm.
and do it in a very strange way. Because, like, I believe that the sickness of spirit, or whatever one would want to call it, the thing that makes us struggle, you know, like, strive like crazy to get to the children's book that talks about caterpillars, you know, climbing
mm-hmm.
all over each other to get to the top of a post. When they get up there, they're like, what the heck's here anyway? You know, most people spend all of their life keeping up with the Joneses, who they don't like anyway.
Right.
You know? And what the sense of any of this stuff is, I don't know. So what I try to do is take a very basic truth
mm-hmm.
that nobody seems to see, and then maybe address it in a different way and
mm-hmm.
say, hey, you know, like, this is what's being wrong. I don't care what happens, you cannot layer and layer and layer corrections
mm-hmm.
over the original problem without addressing
mm-hmm.
the original problem,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it won't work.
Mm-hmm. Exactly,
for each,
exactly. That's what we've been content with for centuries.
Sure.
And that's the problem in social work. Layers of layers,
yeah.
little plaster
sorry.
Here, a little drop there, and the underlying issue is not addressed.
That's right.
So
the
it just helps to keep the underlying structures intact.
And out of every solution arises more problems.
Yeah.
And it just keeps going on like that,
it's
and
like
it's great.
Redirecting the rivers, right?
Yeah.
No, it's
you know, and
you.
The talk today about sustainable development. My answer
just
is that, just get the hell out.
Sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Who
just,
says
just
what's
leave
sustainable?
It alone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, like what I try to do in the writing that I, because like I work on
mm-hmm.
two or three different in two or three different strategies,
mm-hmm.
and those strategies include, like myself as a writer,
mm-hmm.
and what I do creatively is very different than what I do for Arts Craft Magazine,
mm-hmm.
and those are the things I'd like to share with you.
Mm-hmm.
I find them to be, you know, I sit down at the computer, somebody writes for a while, and then I get up and leave, you know,
mm-hmm,
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something there that is in simple language, because I can talk technically, I can use technical terminology,
mm-hmm,
but who does that really talk to?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Simple language, and I think some of the concepts I deal with are fairly complex,
mm-hmm,
though.
You write poetry, too.
I write poetry as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't write as much poetry as I used to, although I'm kind of wondering why.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that is where you saw poetry.
That's a good question.
And another part of it is sometimes the medium does determine the message.
Yeah.
And there, it's just like everything else, you know, like it's really hard to waltz to a polka. You know?
Yeah.
So one has to determine the kind of style or the kind of thing that wants to be said, and then determine an appropriate tool to say it with.
Mm-hmm.
And there's times when I use poetry, such as, I'll just quote you a real quick one. I was sitting and I was thinking about myself, and I was thinking, I spend so much time in introspection, I call it terminal introspection,
mm-hmm,
because it seems like
yeah,
a trap.
Yeah.
That I wrote a poem about that. It's about navel gazing. It's called Midpoint Ponderings. And it's also about optimism, I think. It goes like this. Periodically I reflect upon the ruby in my navel. Great things I see there, profound, philosophical, and rosy. Then I look again and see no ruby. Just a wrinkled up belly button. Rosy hue has fled, but at least it's an innie. Just as stupid, you know.
That's
but,
nice.